Hello, I'm Kevin Keith. In this episode of Skeptical Ethics, we'll look at an intriguing new way of monitoring and understanding patterns of crime and the implications that has for the methods and ethics of the development of conceptual models of real-world phenomena. Before we start, let me remind listeners that the Skeptical Ethics series attempts to apply skeptical reasoning to value-based issues such as moral or cultural controversies. New listeners, or those who want to review the basic conceptual grounding of that enterprise, may wish to download the first Skeptical Ethics segment, Does Skepticism Lead to Agreement?, which appeared in Episode 2 of the Skeptical Connections podcast, and the second segment, Moral Agreement Among Skeptics, from Episode 3 of Skeptical Connections, for useful background. In the December 6, 2012 episode of Morning Edition on National Public Radio, Shankar Vedantam discussed a project by Professor April Zioli of the Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice. Quote, "We looked at homicide as an infectious disease. To spread, an infectious disease needs three things: a source of infection, a mode of transmission, and we need a susceptible population," end quote. By tracking the time and location of every homicide committed in Newark, New Jersey over a period of 25 years, ending in 2007, they identified patterns of homicide arising in certain neighborhoods and spreading from one neighborhood to another. They noticed that these homicides tended to be clustered in certain neighborhoods, but that others were relatively free of homicide, even though such crimes had occurred in other neighborhoods nearby. In a paper published on this project, Zioli and her colleagues wrote, quote, "We hypothesized that the distribution of this crime was not random, but that it moved in a process similar to an infectious disease, with firearms and gangs operating as the infectious agents," end quote. They discovered that the patterns of occurrence and spread of homicides could be modeled with the same software used to track infection epidemics. From this fact, they drew certain conclusions. Vedantam reports, quote, "The value of tracking murder in this fashion," Zioli said, "was not just to let police know where murder was happening. Police already track hotspots and direct resources to those areas, but to make predictions about where homicide might spread next, based on the path of the epidemic." Zioli said that the model could make specific predictions about how and where homicide would spread in the future. To use the language of infectious disease research, Zioli said, "Once researchers figure out what makes some neighborhoods resistant to homicide, despite having the same risk factors as areas with high homicide rates, policymakers could apply those insights to inoculate other areas in order to prevent homicide from spreading," end quote. This is a fascinating approach to crime fighting, and the fact that crime waves can be modeled similarly to infectious epidemics is obviously thought-provoking. But there's a lot embedded in this approach that, as skeptics, we should make the effort to tease out and understand. First, there is the overall approach itself. Attempting to model crime with the dynamics of infection in order to be useful requires that there be some valid relationship or similarity between them. It may just be coincidental that crime and infection spread in similar patterns, but the point to doing a modeling of this kind is precisely that the pattern it detects is not random or coincidental. The model captures the reality of the situation in some way, usually because the model employs factors or parameters that correlate to actual, real-world features of the thing being studied. And when a given model accurately reproduces widely different phenomena, it is because there is something similar about them in terms of such real-world factors. This study implicitly presupposes that the spread of crime and of infection operate through similar mechanisms, and that the similarity in their patterns is not coincidental. In addition, the comments by the researchers in this case make clear another aspect of modeling projects such as this. Their accurate reflection of the real-world phenomenon is believed to give them predictive power. The researchers in this case state explicitly that they can predict crime patterns using their epidemiology software and past patterns of crime in a given area. Obviously, this has important implications for public policy, but it also points up the fundamental assumption underlying the study, that crime patterns exhibit a kind of deterministic or possibly biological inevitability, that knowing how crime has spread in the past tells you how it will spread in the future in the same way that natural phenomena such as disease epidemics can be predicted. And that leads to the final implication of such projects, that the two things being modeled, crime and disease in this case, are identical in some fundamental way. That belief is revealed in the researchers' language of resistance, risk factors, and inoculation to describe crime-fighting strategies based on their studies of historical patterns. It appears in the suggestion to study the low-crime areas to identify factors leading to resistance to crime, as if there were some sort of immunity to crime, similar to immunity to disease. Crime here is being treated not just as similar to a disease, but as a disease. That perspective makes it possible to imagine that the spread of crime is driven by risk factors and immune factors, and to model crime prevention on the strategies used for epidemic disease prevention. But what ethical issues arise from all this? Of course, these studies operate from implicit assumptions of one kind or another, and it's natural to use an accurate historical study to try to extrapolate future patterns, and to use predictions of future patterns of behavior to attempt to intervene for the social good. What could be wrong with that? And given that the dynamic modeling used seems to be at least somewhat accurate, why wouldn't it be worth trying? My legions of regular listeners may recall a recent segment of Skeptical Ethics from episode 12 of the Skeptical Connections podcast, in which we considered the controversy over a widely promoted economic model of the relationship between national debt and gross domestic product. This model, which claimed that debt above a certain level causes an economic slump, was aggressively touted by right-wing policymakers as justification for slashing social programs in the U.S. and elsewhere. Just recently, it was shown that that model had employed highly questionable mathematics, selective use of data, and a gross coding error that all tended to support its claimed results, which were shown to be false when the errors were corrected. However, austerity policies affecting hundreds of millions of people at the height of a major worldwide recession had already been based on that model. The lesson here was not merely that bad modeling can lead to bad policies, but that researchers and policymakers bear a moral responsibility, not just for their overt actions, but for the reliability and professionalism of the ideological foundations of those actions. The authors of the erroneous economic study were not the leaders of the austerity movement that made use of it, but they provided a flawed tool that was widely used by that movement, and that is a fault in itself. Let me be clear that I am not accusing the authors of the crime and epidemiology study of errors, of cooking their data, or of promoting results driven by an ideological agenda. But the work described has clear ideological overtones that ought to be taken into account, and whose possible implications should be seriously considered. In addition to the empirical assumptions or implications mentioned previously, the study raises other implications and references that can't be ignored. For one thing, any study of crime in America is inevitably a study of the underclass. Crime, especially violent crime such as homicide, is an overwhelmingly class-related phenomenon. And another fact about class in America is that it tracks closely with race. And the history of social perspectives of the non-white underclass includes, among other things, a long history of their treatment as subhuman or animalistic. Standardly racist depictions of black people commonly represent them as monkeys or gorillas. Asians and poor immigrants have often been depicted as invading swarms such as insects or bacteria. And the trope of infection has often been used to oppose immigration by undesired groups, usually non-white. So, inevitably, a study of crime as infection, which is to say a study of non-white underclass behavior as a kind of infection, treads on territory that also harbors a racist history and underlies racial theories of intelligence and social worth. In addition, there are other aspects of this model of social behavior that play into the trope of the underclass as subhuman. The treatment of aspects of crime as infectious agents rather than features of conscious human agency, for instance, firearms and gangs as the equivalent of infection sources and bacterial cultures rather than things that humans use and do, treats human beings as essentially unwitting tools of their own behavior. The most overt example is the assumption, stated explicitly by these researchers, that criminal behavior can be both predicted and prevented by the tools of infectious disease epidemiology. That is, that the fact that mathematical models that describe crime patterns are the same as mathematical models that describe disease means that crime will be increased or decreased in the same way as disease. This assumption takes the similarities between the two models from the realm of analogy to outright identity, an identification that carries very troubling associations. I should pause here to reiterate that I don't accuse these researchers of harboring racist or classist stereotypes, or of regarding their study subjects as subhuman. The point is more subtle and more dangerous, that introducing a representation of human beings and human behavior in non-human terms makes it possible to begin to shape policies that also overlook the human dimension of the phenomenon in question, and in ways that themselves don't require stereotyping or malice. For instance, if crime is the result of an infectious process, then it's not the result of poverty, unemployment, discrimination, lack of infrastructure, lack of education, or other desocializing forces. If the way to prevent crime is to treat human beings like bacteria and wipe out the infection, or immunize the healthy neighborhoods against their infectious neighbors, then it's not to improve conditions to allow greater independence and flourishing in those unhealthy neighborhoods, or to provide resources to those at risk of falling into crime. After all, that would be like feeding the infection. Cases such as these call out for understanding the implications, and, as in the case of the erroneous economic modeling that led to so much destructive social policy, the possible uses of seemingly abstract theoretical models. It's easy to understand and empathize with researchers who found this intriguing relationship and wanted to explore it. That's how good science is done. But science, particularly of human lives and human behavior, must be done with an eye to the larger context it resides in, on the part both of those who put science to practical use in public policy and of those who make that science available for such uses. The common human practice of analogy and modeling as a tool of explanation can lend itself to ill-judged or even malicious uses, a power, for good or for ill, that must never be overlooked. If you happen to be one of my legions of regular listeners, I'd be glad to hear your comments and reactions directed to skepticalconnections.com.